You honor me with your words. Thank you, Phil. I want to acknowledge here that we are standing in Mi'kma'ki. It's the traditional and unceded territory of the Mi'kmaq people and this beautiful island that they called Apegwik, later named St. John's Island by the French, who claimed the island in 1604, then named Prince Edward Island by the British in 1798, because they rightly thought that we didn't need a third St. John in the area. Thank you for this opportunity to come together. It's wonderful to meet you. As brothers and sisters in Christ, I had the privilege of speaking at the Montague site a month and a bit ago, where I did a Saturday morning session on the resurrection of Jesus, and then spoke on Sunday. And if you are interested at all in that, those are recorded and they're on your podcast feeds. I want to acknowledge Phil and his leadership here, as well as the leadership team that works with him. And I want to be respectful of the goal of this series. I've listened to the entire series and really enjoyed it and appreciated it. There have been two ways that the church has often approached culture, and they're both on the extreme end. So you have Christian communities that retreat entirely. Think of kind of Amish communities that separate themselves. Then you have churches that fully immerse in the political discourse such that sometimes you can't tell them apart. And I think we see that to an unhealthy degree in some aspects of the U.S. But much more difficult is that balance that we're trying to strike here, of pledging our allegiance first and foremost to Jesus the Christ and his kingdom, and then seeking to engage with the surrounding culture around us, because we all swim in culture, right? Culture carries us along. Imagine being floating along in a river, and culture carries you. And we need to recognize when the culture is carrying us a place where we shouldn't go. We need to recognize when the culture is carrying us a place where we should go and swim along with it so that we're out in front. And sometimes we need to throw an anchor and say we're not moving from the space that we're at. And the conversations that you've had through this series, you can see where some of those fit, where we have to throw our anchor, say we're not moving from our space. But we need to recognize, and you have recognized, oh, this is good. We need to swim along with this. We need to lead the way as Christ followers. And what we're doing at Acadia, we call this cultural exegesis. So exegesis is a technical term that we use usually for the Bible, where we look to the Bible and seek to understand, what did that author say to those first people who first received this letter? You know, when Paul wrote this, what did he mean? That's exegesis, the proper interpretation of a text. Cultural exegesis is looking at the culture around us and saying, what's the culture telling us? And then how do we react to that? Okay? This is a good spot where I need to interject a quick announcement for Acadia Divinity College, because I work there, and the president of Acadia Divinity College, Harry Gardner, he has spies in every Baptist church, and we need to give our quick 2 minutes. But ADC is a great place to work. I want to encourage you that if you've thought of theological education at all, please come talk to me or make contact with the Divinity College. You can study with us without leaving the island. Okay? Phil and I were both graduates there. Don't let that tarnish its reputation too much. And I'm really happy that Pastor Tyler Proud is also going to be studying with us this coming year too. In this particular conversation, I want to alert you to the McCrae Center. So we have a center, the McCrae Center for Faith and Culture. It's led by Anna Robbins, who's our professor of ethics. And she blogs regularly. They create videos. She's done shooting. They did a Christ and Culture. I mean, this is directly relevant to what you guys are doing. A Christ and Culture video series, along with accompanying discussion workbook, and it's going to be free for all the churches. So they just finished that, and it's currently being produced. So what Anna does at that center, what Phil has been modeling for you, and again, it's modeling it for you, is seeking to engage with the culture critically as Christ followers. So Phil asked me to come and talk about the larger Canadian conversation around Indigenous issues. We all have mixed ancestry here. The one that I lean into is my mother's, as my mother is the one who raised me. And when I think of my family, I think of my mom's side of the family, the Andersons. And my maternal ancestors lived in Manitoba long before any settlers arrived, and then they later intermarried with Scottish settlers, so I just have enough Scottish in me that I enjoy the bagpipes. I've tried to learn about this conversation and my own history in these last few years and to theologically reflect on what this means for me to be Indigenous and Christian as a follower of Jesus. What does it mean? What can it look like? What should it look like as an Indigenous person to follow Jesus? For many years, I didn't even know I was an Indigenous person. I didn't know until I was a teenager. because my mom and her siblings were so severely discriminated against that when they were young, they would often tell us that they would run home crying because they'd just been beaten up again, and they would cry, "We don't want to be Indians, Mom and Dad. We don't want to be Indians." They grew up with that, and so they didn't want us to feel that way, and so they didn't talk about it. And yet they were models of Christian, they were the model Christian family. I've said before, and I'll say it again, I don't think any family can outsing my family except the Gaithers. We're excellent, and we love those old-time hymns. They went to church several times a week, and yet it was the color of their skin by which they were judged in their community. So is the conversation that we're having in this country around the work of truth and reconciliation, does this align with kingdom values? This is the question we're asking. I remind us of the text that's been used several times from Ephesians 4. Until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, a mature person attaining the measure of Christ's full stature, so that we're no longer to be children, tossed back and forth by waves and carried about by every wind of teaching, by the trickery of people who craftily carry out their deceitful schemes. But practicing the truth in love, we will in all things grow up into Christ, who is the head. There's so much history behind this conversation that I need to talk quite a bit about history today. And Phil mentioned it, and I'll just mention it again. Buckle up, I need to give you a lot of information. The title of this series is O Canada. This is my first slide here. What does it mean to call this place Canada? We've tackled some big issues, but the difference between this issue and the other issues that you've tackled is that we're going back right to the beginnings of the story of this place that we call Canada. Because the Indigenous people have been here for a long time, so we are tackling and I'm questioning our origin story as a country. What does it mean to name something? God names people. He gave people new names. If you remember the biblical story, Abram becomes Abraham. Sarah becomes Sarah again, but with a different spelling. And Jacob becomes Israel. And in Revelation 2:17, it suggested that believers receive new names as well. Names are given as markers of relational changes and of lordship over a person or a thing. Now, I began my sermon by recognizing the territory that I'm in. And this is an example from our province here, the one I'm sitting on here, your province, the one I'm visiting. It can be replicated across Canada, where we had different territorial names that were then changed as other people took over. But prior to this, Canada was part of something that was called Turtle Island. And we reside in Mi'kma'ki. Mi'kma'ki was a territory that covered Nova Scotia, all of Nova Scotia, all of New Brunswick, all of the island, portions of Quebec, and perhaps even Maine and Labrador. I have a slide there. And so for people like the Mi'kmaq, who rightly consider themselves a nation, who have a traditional territory with borders that have been ignored, with land that's been stolen and renamed, why celebrate something like Canada Day, where we just passed the 151st? It was a huge celebration. I celebrated too. Don't misunderstand me. But First Nations people can trace their heritage to the territories that they're in through the place that we call Canada for thousands of years. Just Us Coffee, nearby me, put up this sign at the 150th. They weren't trying to be provocative. They were just trying to remind everyone, this land has been here and people have resided here for a lot longer than 150 years. Now, I came over to the island today over Confederation Bridge. This is one of our stories in the island. I keep saying our. Just pretend I live here, too. And we have the Fathers of Confederation that gathered in 1864 to hammer out what was going to be the Dominion of Canada. Those were crucial meetings that led to Canada. And let me ask you, where were the chiefs? There are no chiefs of Confederation. The Indigenous peoples were considered a problem to be solved. Unfortunate roadblocks to Western expansion, which were dealt with later via treaties, which I'll talk about. I want to read to you a quote from John Macdonald, who was our first Prime Minister. And he is writing to people in Saskatchewan and Manitoba as he's looking for Canada, which began as Ontario, Quebec, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, to expand west. So here's what he says. "Sir, we are looking anxiously for your report as to the Indian titles, both within Manitoba and without, and as to the best means of extinguishing the Indian titles in the Valley of Saskatchewan. Would you kindly give us your view on that point, officially and unofficially? We should take immediate steps to extinguish the Indian titles somewhere in the fertile belt in the Valley of Saskatchewan and open it for settlement there will otherwise be an influx of squatters who will seize upon the most eligible positions and greatly disturb the symmetry of future surveys. Essentially, he's saying, we got to figure out a way to clear the plains, to get the indigenous population out of the way for the settlers. Now, John MacDonald was a racist, he was a colonizer, he was a misogynist. He wasn't really any different. He was a man of his time. There's a lot of people like that there today. The difference, of course, is that he held tremendous power, and he helped found this country. Now, even if we decided, as First Nations people, that we were going to move past the issue of Canada, calling it Canada, can we really talk about Canada, a singular entity? This is my next slide. Can we talk about a shared experience as citizens? Now, I recognize there's a lot of hurt in Canada. There's a lot of poor people. There's a lot of people that are not experiencing life as it should be. What I'm talking about here specifically is it woven into our governmental system, our constitution, to treat people the same? And I want to suggest to you that this is not actually the case. There is a lot of racism that is built into the fabric of our nation. There's a lot to cover here. I'm going to try and be as quick as I can to leave space for the question-response time we talked about. But I want to state that I think we need to talk about two Canadas. First off, all countries that were colonized by European nations were done so on something called the Doctrine of Discovery. So the Doctrine of Discovery was an edict given by the Pope in a series of what they called papal bulls. So it comes from the Pope. It's an official document declaring something. And these Doctrine of Discovery papal bulls said, any country, any Christian country, if they go and they find land uninhabited by Christian peoples, can claim it for the country that has been sent from. Okay, so it is literally, just like you think of it in the movies, or we've seen it sometimes, where they would get on a new piece of land, they would say, there are no other white people here, they would plant their flag, and they would declare, this is now the product, of, or sorry, the now the dominion of Spain, or whatever it might be, or they would roll out the long scroll, and someone would read the declaration that this country or this land now belongs to the French, and they'd be reading it to people who didn't understand what they were saying. And so the Doctrine of Discovery is part of the fabric of our nation. Okay, it was why they felt they could just take it over, because they had the authority of the church. They had the authority of the Pope back home to do this. And so that's why there was this rush from Europe. As they found North America, and more boats come over with people on them, it's because they want to find more lands so that they can claim it for the country back home. This is the Doctrine of Discovery. It continues to be the case that we see remnants of the Doctrine of Discovery even up to the present. I have been keeping an eye on the discussion in Western PEI over the sale of Mill River, purchased by the Blue Jays owner. It is Crown land. Anytime we have Crown land, that is land taken from the indigenous people by the government. And this is a quote from the Crown attorney, or about the Crown attorney. While the consultations were not perfect, he said, they were hampered by the chief's misapprehension that, in effect, they had a veto over any sale. Campbell said that belief was based on the Mi'kmaq's asserted claim to the lands in question. However, he said, for government to require consent from the Mi'kmaq to dispose of the land, that title claim would have to be proven, and the onus was on the Mi'kmaq to do that. In other words, the Mi'kmaq have no claim to this land because it already belongs to the Crown. This is the Doctrine of Discovery. So if the Doctrine of Discovery helped propel the first settlers to claim this land on behalf of another country, I didn't mention this in the first in my first sermon, but my father and his parents came over from Austria, and they came to Manitoba, and then ancestors on my mom's side who were Scottish, you can see back in archives letters that they would send back to Europe saying, if you come over, we'll give you this much amount of land, because they wanted settlers to come over. Again, all of that land was land that they first took from the indigenous people, and then they said, okay, if you're a European settler, you can come over and we'll give it to you for free. So even in my own past, I have family who would have benefited from that. Now, I seem to remember a commandment about stealing. I seem to remember another commandment from God about coveting. Coveting is the strong desire to have that which belongs to another. This is something that plagues our modern society. Something that's exacerbated tenfold by social media. Covetousness. Now there's another story from the Bible about King Ahab, the wicked king. And he was walking along and saw a beautiful vineyard owned by a man named Naboth, and he wanted it. Naboth said, "No, this is my family vineyard. It's been my family's vineyard for generations." He wouldn't sell it. And Ahab really, really wanted it. His wife Jezebel conspires to kill Naboth, and therefore King Ahab got the vineyard. This is in 1 Kings 21. How do you think God felt about that action? He burned with anger towards the king. This was recognized early on. I have a slide up there. This is a quote from an indigenous person. He was an early missionary. He accepted the gospel. He became a missionary, but he was still critical of what was going on around him. He just didn't accept it. He said, "I've read the Bible. God doesn't approve of stealing lands," and yet it continued to happen. And so, if I'm right in saying that much of Canada was stolen unjustly, then this means that our houses, our businesses, our churches sit on land unjustly taken. Are we not right to perhaps conclude God is not happy about this? That perhaps he wants us to make it right? You learned also in previous parts of the series about the Jubilee year. God takes the possession and ownership of land seriously. Much of the land was taken in later times through treaties. Treaties, if you look up in the definition, is an agreement made between two or more sovereign nations about how they are going to live together. Sovereign nations. The Dominion of Canada, the upcoming Dominion of Canada, made a treaty with First Nations, and that's why we call them First Nations. They were recognized as sovereign people. The bulk of Canada is covered under numbered treaties. This is my colorful photo here. But in the Maritimes here, we're governed under something called the Treaties of Peace and Friendship. All of the treaties together, 1871 to 1921 is when they were made. And the Peace and Friendship Treaties in the Maritimes were ratified several times. Now, these treaties were made, again, by sovereign nations. This is the good part. The bad part, unfortunately, by that time, the First Nations people were so destitute that they felt that this was the only way forward. First Nations people are deeply connected to land, and I say this with all due respect to all of you, as well as myself, because I don't identify with land in the same way. But First Nations people are much more connected to their land than we are, because we've only been here a couple hundred years. They've been here a couple thousand. So when they signed treaties, they did so because they needed to know that their children would have a better future. And so certain parts of land was devoted to them, including reserve land and other land, and the government said, "This is now the land that is yours. The rest is what we are taking for the settlers as for crown land." They also had other treaty benefits, as well as the promise for education, which I'm going to talk about in a second. I'm the sixth generation since the signing of Treaty 1 in Manitoba, and my ancestors were all represented by Chief William Prince. And according to my research, he was a Baptist. Now, almost without exception, when you hear about land claims issues or First Nations in court, it has to do with the government not fulfilling the promises or holding to the agreements made in treaties. Let me give you a couple of simple examples from Nova Scotia. In 1927, a man went out to fish. He went out to fish knowing that he was going to be arrested immediately. Despite the Treaty of Peace and Friendship, which allowed them hunting and fishing rights, the government had repressed that, the provincial government. They weren't allowed to. This guy went out fishing and intentionally got arrested so that he could protest that in court. He went all the way up to the Supreme Court and still lost. It happened again in 1985, this time all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court told the province they have a treaty right, and he was allowed to fish. Not content with that, the province arrested someone again in 1993, and again all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court stated, no, they have a treaty right to fish. So the province continually pushed back, did not want to hold to their word in the treaties, and the Supreme Court had to come in and stand up for that indigenous person. This hasn't happened since, and hopefully it won't happen again. The government, our current government, just a few months ago in February, they also assented to the United Nations Declaration of Rights for Indigenous Peoples. This was just February in this year. I really want to encourage you to read this document. It's pretty common sense. It's plain. It makes sense that people who lived in traditional lands deserve certain rights. And so is it not right, as followers of Jesus, you and I, to simply tell the government, hey, just stay true to your word. You made an agreement with these people under treaties. You've now said you want to follow the United Nations Declaration. Then just as citizens of this country, maybe we should just say, hey, stick to your word. Our country has race-based legislation as well. It's called the Indian Act. In 1876, it was a way to try and have a coordinated indigenous policy. It also took from the communities the ability to determine who their people were. It now became a matter for the federal government to decide who was indigenous and who was not. It's race-based. If someone has a federal treaty card, it's because of the Indian Act. And the hope of the Indian Act, along with almost all of indigenous policy, is to try and assimilate them. The Indian Act has a lot of problems with it. I'm going to list a few so that you can understand a little bit what it means to be a First Nation person, especially on reserve. And this is really what I mean when I say perhaps there are two Canadas. First off, like I said, it's race-based. Second, it gave control of those reserves, which were the treaty agreements. This is now going to be your treaty land. It actually took control of the reserves and gave it to the federal government, effectively making them the landlords. And the people are just leasing the land. They're just tenants. This gave them the ability to even entirely relocate reserves if they felt that they were in the way. This happened, for instance, in Cape Breton. It happened, it's happened many of times, but I'm trying to think of one close. That's the closest one, where the community was on the river because that's where they made their livelihood. But Sydney wanted to grow. They were in the way, and so they just moved them into a very poor land area, swampy area, and denied them access to the river from which they derived much of their life. In Manitoba, it happened to my ancestors. They were moved forcibly to a reserve called St. Peter's Reserve, further up north where it was harsher climate and not as good a soil, to make room for the settler farmers. The problem is that the First Nations had been living there thousands of years and figured out how to still farm well, and St. Peter's Reserve and their commerce became too large. They were doing too well, and so they were disbanded and moved again and separated into two reserves. And they could do all of this because the Indian Act gave them the right over the land. If you ever see pictures, or if you've ever been through a reserve and you see broken down houses and you wonder, how can anyone live there? Why don't they just fix up the house? Perhaps you said this. Phil told me. I've even said that as I've seen houses like this. The problem is they don't own those houses. The federal government owns those houses. The federal government is the landlord, and they're the ones that are supposed to fix it up. The people on reserve are just tenants. Indians on reserve needed permission to leave the reserve. Imagine needing permission to leave Cornwall from a local agent. This was life for people on reserve. They weren't allowed to organize politically. They weren't allowed to purchase alcohol or ammunition. A certain type of government was imposed upon them that was not natural for all the First Nations. They were forbade from using their language or practicing their religion. They weren't allowed to even dress up in their regalia to dance publicly in powwows. They were not allowed to vote. And they had to receive permits to sell products from their farms so as not to impede on the commerce of settlers. They also have less or no medical coverage depending on where they are. This issue really came to a head a number of years ago with a little boy named Jordan River Anderson. He was born in Manitoba with a muscular disorder, spent his first years in the hospital receiving some treatment, not his full treatment. He was given leave to stay at home with a full-time home care. The problem is that the federal government and the provincial government, because he wasn't on reserve and he was a reserve child, They couldn't decide who should pay for this. And he ended up dying in hospital. He died in hospital because he did not receive adequate care. He did not receive adequate care because they couldn't decide who should pay. They couldn't decide who should pay because he was indigenous. Jordan's principle is to ensure equity of access for all government funds for First Nations children. Should there ever have been a need for this type of principle in our country? The Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, which is a legal institution in Canada, has since that time twice charged the government with improperly implementing Jordan's principle. This includes 2017, less than a year ago, where they noted 22 cases of Indigenous children who did not receive proper access to health care. I'm not talking about ancient history. I've just hit you with a lot of information. A lot of it was new to you, I imagine. I want to talk in the last few minutes specifically about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, why that happened, and why it is such an important conversation that we need to be a part of. It happened because of Indian residential schools. Now, residential schools had been around for a time in Canada already, but they came to be aggressively used after the Indian Act in 1879, when the government asked the churches to begin running schools in order to Christianize the First Nation population. Recall that I said from the treaties that they asked for education. Okay, so the First Nations people wanted educations for their children for their future. They wanted them, though, on reserve. They wanted them close by, but the government moved them far away. This, coupled with the fact that the government really wanted to get rid of the Indian problem, they wanted to assimilate them, meant that they took what was to be a treaty obligation and they made it into a tool of assimilation. I want to show you a quote from John A. MacDonald. "When the school is on the reserve, the child lives with its parents, who are savages, and though he may learn to read and write, his habits and training mode of thought are Indian. He's simply a savage who can read and write. It has been strongly impressed upon myself, as head of the department, that Indian children should be withdrawn as much as possible from the parental influence, and the only way to do that would be to put them in central training industrial schools, where they will acquire the habits and modes of thought of white men." That's 1879. So the residential schools became a desire to kill the Indian in the child. It's rightly been labeled cultural genocide. And First Nations peoples, like I said, they wanted the education. However, they swiftly realized that they didn't actually have a choice. The Indian Act enforced the education, such that children were taken from their parents, even if they didn't want to send them. And as children returned and reported issues to parents of neglect, malnourishment, abuse, they had no choice but to send them back. They came for the children. Take a moment and feel that. Think about your own children. How would it break and scar your family? And let me ask you, what level of depravity is a country at when it targets children? What level of depravity is a country at when the goal is to fracture permanently the family union? Now, I'm a follower of Jesus, and Jesus talked about the devil who seeks to kill and destroy. It seems like the devil's work. The assimilation goal, though, was a failure. The education goal was only partially successful, because as they ramped it up, it became clear that it was more about the Christianization or the assimilation than about the education. They began, prior to the Indian Act, learning valuable trades, but it degraded. They went from learning how to become a farmer to how to become a farmhand, to fulfill the lowest rung of jobs in society. Now, as students graduated and started to come back home, stories of abuse and prisoner-like atmosphere started arising, and lawsuits began forming against the government, because the government was the one running them. This led rightly to an apology by Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and it launched a 5-year Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was a series of events across Canada. One happened in Halifax. And it was an opportunity for anyone from any survivor from a residential school to come and tell their story. And they were not given any time limits. They were allowed to tell as much or as little of their story as they wanted. and people were invited to come and to listen. Many of those are also recorded. Those who were willing to tell the story a second time, I'm going to tell you how you can access those if you're interested. Now, the victims could have refused this offer by the Prime Minister, and there's no doubt that they would have won their lawsuits. Their cases were airtight. But the First Nations communities wanted healing. They wanted that more than they wanted money. The way that demons are expelled and the way powers are disarmed is when courageous people speak out against the evil. And that's what they did. They wanted to seek healing for their communities. Now, when the work was completed of this Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the results were worse than they expected. 50% of the students came back and had positive stories, so please do hear that. Some could even be listed as very positive, where they came out speaking of caring teachers, lasting friendships, and good education. But about 50% of those kids who gave their reports reported abuse of some kind, 50%. Now, some of it may have been small acts of mourning, like, for instance, when they were sent in their best clothes, and the first thing that happened to them was they were stripped of all of their possessions, and their hair was cut. Now, in First Nations, long hair is a symbol of pride, and when you cut your hair, it's a symbol of mourning. And so they were wondering, as children, why are we mourning? And why are we staying in a mourning period? So this, perhaps, was the trauma, a smallish amount. For some of them, the trauma was malnutrition. Now, this is what I can't believe. So in 1907, this is before they ramp up the residential schools and the churches take over, the government asks a doctor, Dr. Peter Bryce, to assess the health situation of the schools. And he comes back. He's the inspector for the department. And he did not attempt to disguise his horror. He talked about tuberculosis being an epidemic. He called it a national crime because of the inadequate funding, poorly constructed schools, sanitary ventilation problems, inadequate diet and clothing and medical care. He even wrote a book, A National Crime. He calculated the mortality rate at some of the schools as 35 to 60%. The government didn't like that report. Despite being called a national crime, despite the fact that they hired their own person to do it, they made little to no improvement and actually ramped it up under the leadership of a guy named Duncan Campbell Scott. I have a picture of him up there. The schools were then, at that point, made compulsory, even though they had just received such a terrible report. And that's the malnutrition. But then we get to more stories of beatings, terrible abuses for those caught speaking their language. You weren't allowed to speak your language at a residential school. Others about being locked up into places of solitary confinement, and still more about being sexually abused. So 50% of 150,000 students in total reporting abuse. I mentioned malnourishment, and because of this, because of those abysmal conditions and the lack of social support, which all of us need, we all need family, we all need friends around us, and that was denied to them. One school in Alberta had a total mortality rate of over 50%. That's not abuse rate, that's mortality rate. More than that, think about the widespread individual, family, and community damage that this has caused. It will last for generations. This is not ancient history. This is present-day realities. The last residential school closed in 1996, and I graduated in 1997. This isn't ancient history. The TRC brought forth 94 calls to action. The government has committed to answering all of those calls to action. Some of those were to the church, and the churches have done well. In particular, I shouldn't say all the churches. Some of the churches have done well. The Anglican Church in particular has done well in responding. The Mennonite Church has really been at the forefront in the evangelical circles for education and being allies with the Indigenous people. And I'm currently working with our denomination here for ways to respond. So just in closing, what do we do with all of this? I give my enthusiastic yes to the question of whether or not this is a good conversation that we're having in Canada. And should we be a part of it? Yes, yes, yes. But how do we seek right relationship? How do we seek to respond? First off, we need to educate ourselves. A few people after the first service said, I just didn't know any of this. And I understand that. I didn't learn any of this either in school. It's gotten better for my kids anyway in Nova Scotia. The education about First Nations has been vastly improved. I want to suggest to you a website. It's really easy to remember, wherearethechildren.ca. There's a timeline for the residential schools. There are those who are willing to give their testimony again, recorded in full, as well as other things. If you're prepared for it, there's a documentary called We Were Children. It's very difficult to watch. Also learn about the TRC, and I suggested before reading the United Nations Declaration for the Rights of Indigenous People. Like I said, the second thing that we can do is simply hold our government to account. The government has made promises and treaties. It's part of the bylaws, as it were, of our country. They have assented to the United Nations Declaration. They've also committed to the calls to action. Whether or not you like the party that's in power, it should be a simple matter for us to say, just stay true to your word then. Finally, as individuals and as groups, we need to recognize that we're in relationship with Indigenous peoples. If you're a settler here, you're in relationship because the government worked on behalf of you and your future generations to be settlers in this country. And they still welcome the settlers today. The First Nations people still honor the treaties, and they're asking the other person on the other side of the treaty to also keep honoring the treaties. But it's a slap in the face when we don't recognize the history and when we go about our day not even recognizing the land that we're on. So for instance, one simple example is that universities across the Maritimes now always open major events with an acknowledgement of Mi'kma'ki in the way that I did at the beginning of the sermon. In my recommendations, the denomination will start doing the same in our yearly meeting. And even at the local church level, it's, I think, appropriate to acknowledge it on websites and weekly bulletins. Because the issue is that the gospel, which means good news, has been bad news for the Indigenous people for hundreds of years. The missionaries came as tools of government oppression and assimilation. They didn't want to educate them, they wanted to Christianize them. When the message of the gospel went out, it was dressed like a European. We need to make efforts to establish right relationships again and become permanent and lasting allies. And lastly, I want to suggest that you continue to do what has been done here today, and that's learn about Indigenous people from an Indigenous person like myself. There's a lot of wisdom embodied in the community, and I can tell you as a biblical scholar, the First Nations Indigenous worldview in some aspects is much more closely aligned with the biblical worldview than with Western Christianity. We can learn a lot from them. Thank you.
We're going to move into just a bit of a Q&A. And Beatrice, if you could put up that slide with my cell phone on it. I know that there can be like awkwardness around wanting to ask a question but don't want to like show your white guilt, ignorant self. So I'll start by that, and hopefully that will kind of create a climate that people can ask the question. I want to go back to two things. It makes me feel bad. And you're like, I don't care. but how do you get around, like I live on a piece of property I understand that's not my own. And when you talk about that churches sit on, your houses sit on land, what do I do now as a Christ follower? I know that people that don't know the Lord, by and large, just don't care. But for a Christ follower, what do I do now with that in mind as I do life with great people like you? How do I bring those things together in a way that makes sense, that honors Christ? Just walk us through that.
Yeah, I'm going to stand to answer.
I know, you like to stand.
I like to stand. That's a good question. The First Nations people, when the settlers first arrived, they welcomed them with open arms. And they helped them to live in a harsher climate than they were used to, especially if you go higher north. They taught them how to hunt, how to fish. And as the settlers increased in number and created their own settlements, the First Nations people helped them with that as well. They were welcoming people. The reason that they were welcoming people is because, again, remember I said that their worldview is much more closely aligned at times with the biblical worldview? They see themselves in direct relationship with the Creator. So here's something a lot of people don't realize about First Nations people, and this is true of almost every Indigenous community across the globe. They are monotheistic. They believe in one creator God. Okay? And they believe that the creator God gave them this land as a responsibility to watch over. That's very biblically accurate. Right? The earth is the Lord's and everything in it. We think about, because we are good capitalists, good Western capitalists, we like our property. This is ours. This is mine. Well, that's not the biblical worldview. And so indigenous people are not saying, you know, give us our land and go home. Right? Rather, they're saying, let's live in relationship together, and we want you to recognize where you are. A good example is something called the Wampum Belt. So the Wampum Belt was representative of the treaties. So imagine a long white belt. It was a beaded belt. And then there was two lines of blue that went across, and those represented rivers. And then on those rivers were two canoes. And those represented the fact that they said, we welcome you here, and let's exist side by side, and let's go together and flourish together, and let's not impede one another. Okay? The problem is that our river has continued, and theirs have been dammed up. Okay? We didn't allow them to flourish and continue. And so when you talk about what do we do as Christian people today, it's first off educating ourselves and acknowledging it. But here in PEI, I want to suggest to you that you try and take steps as individuals and corporately to try and get to know the Mi'kmaq in the area. I mentioned to Phil before, Chief Ramjatin in Lennox Island is a Christian. She's a believer. And she's someone that we can contact and say, how do we start to live together in right relationship? And acknowledge, we don't really know maybe how to go about this, but help us along. Let's live in relationship. Let's get back to that living side by side and helping each other flourish. Because that's not when things aren't flourishing, it's always on the indigenous side right now, and that's not fair.
A question that came in, why are there some reserves that appear to be more wealthier than others, or some are in great shape and others seem to be just in complete disarray and disrepair?
Yeah. So sometimes if things have gone right and businesses or governments start to use land that is part of that reserve land, then they start receiving the benefits of that, and it's well managed, right? And then you have other reserves, especially up north, where everything that they have is almost always strictly coming from the federal government, and it's very little. So someone mentioned to me today, well, what goes on with all the money that gets poured into the First Nations? The First Nations people in Canada is about the population of New Brunswick. New Brunswick gets $15 billion annually from the federal government to manage its people. The First Nations gets $14 billion. Okay? So it's not actually that they're getting tons and tons more money. That's not the case. The other aspect is just that sin affects everyone. And sometimes you have poor leadership on reserves, and that's just the case. And then sometimes you have really great leadership. And that leadership helps propel the community to be self-sufficient and to grow. And so that's why you have these extremes within the reserves in Canada.
John MacDonald was a racist towards the First Nations people, and racism will always be in existence in our country and by extension around the world. How can a true Christ follower see every color as one, as we are all created by God?
I want to say that you shouldn't see it as one. Okay, so that's the first thing. Indigenous people want you to see them as indigenous and appreciate them because that's how God created them. I understand the sentiment, though. So let me say that to whoever texted that in. I remember one time a friend of my wife. So my wife is from Guatemala, and one time one of her friends said, "Well, when I see you, I just see you as white," and that's what I do to everyone. I just don't see a color. And my wife said, "Well, I want you to see my color. That's part of me. That's who I am, right? That's part of my culture." And then this her friend, who is a white lady, was saying, "Well, no, that's not how you should want to be seen." And my wife's like, "No, but I'm telling you, that's how we want to be seen. That's part of our culture." So it's not that we want you to try and treat everyone the same. It's rather we want you to see the beauty of God's image in all people.
Another question. in Canada prior European colonization, was there a warring over lands and kind of groups of indigenous people warring against other groups of indigenous? There was a kind of a changing of lands prior colonization.
Yeah. There certainly were. It's it wouldn't be as You know how sometimes they say if you look back in human history, it's like it's just unending wars. It wasn't quite like that in the North American perspective. There certainly was some warring allies, but again, particularly in this area, there was a large confederacy called the Wabanaki Confederacy of several groups that agreed to live peaceably, as it were, in the same way that we agree to live peaceably with the U.S. and we have an open border, all that kind of stuff. So there certainly were, because again, First Nations people are human beings just like the rest of us. And then sin affects them just like it affects the rest of us. So there certainly was warring factions, yeah.
Are Indigenous people in their own schools now? Or what is their current education situation like?
Yeah, so part of, especially, this has gotten better, especially after the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but there are certain schools that are Indigenous run, grade level, high school level, even into college, university. Once you get up into the higher levels, they tend to go out. One of the processes of what we call decolonization of the academy, of the universities, is trying to help those students, usually with something like a university elder that is with them and helps them to feel part of a community, because part of the problem is so often when they went off to university, they were so isolated, right, that it was so hard to be there and to flourish. And so part of the efforts of universities is to try and help them foster a community within that university now. But there is levels of all grade school Indigenous run, and it happens on reserve as well as off reserve.
Is it possible to correct years of mistreatment in a generation?
In a generation, no, but I think it's entirely possible to correct the course, and I think it starts with truth telling, and then it starts with deciding what we do from that. So, I had a friend on Facebook said to me, Danny, I get it. He used foul language at me, but he said, I get that my ancestors were all a bunch of jerks, essentially. And he said, what do I do with that? And he said, like, how many times can we say I'm sorry? And I'm thinking, well, what does sorry mean to you? Is it just a word, or do we say sorry? And so what do we do after this now, right? How do we adjust our course? And we need to get beyond just the saying I'm sorry and saying how do we adjust our course? And the problem is we don't want to adjust our course, because sometimes that's uncomfortable for us. But they've been adjusting their course for thousands of years already, and it's gone downhill a lot of times. So, yeah.
I know for me, there's a couple other questions here that we just don't have time for. So I would ask you to kind of corner Danny afterwards, as people did in the first service. It was, I grew up in Oromocto, New Brunswick, a stone's throw away, was a First Nations reserve. And I did drive by many a time and essentially say, my goodness, like, clean up the yard and fix it. And I was unaware that that's not their home, that that's not their property. And I know I take great pride in ownership, that I want to reflect all kinds of things and how I care for what God has given to me. I suspect that for a vast majority of us in the room, that was new information. And afterwards, I think you and I were talking in between services where... Speak to the curse and how it shapes white individuals, Indigenous individuals, and regardless of race, how the curse just destroys that which God had in mind and works its way into our hearts, where we would speak in disparaging ways of one another. Just speak to how we correct that course as we go forward as Christ followers.
Yeah. Well, I think it's highlighted in what you've said often and through this series, is we need to always go back to our origin story as people. and that origin story is that we're in the image of God, all people. And so whenever we see things that deviate from that, that's a product of the fall, right? To not see ourselves made in the image of God. It's equally part of the fall, in my opinion, to say every person is a dirty, rotten sinner, as if that's our foundation. Now, your foundation is you're in the image of God. You're created in the image of God. Yes, you're cracked, right? You're a cracked icon. So the image, the word image in Greek is icon, where we get the word icon from. And so you think of the fall as like it dropped that nice, beautiful icon, and it's cracked now. And Jesus will help us put it back together, right? And that's how we focus on him. So see ourselves at bottom as the image of God in all people, and then help, ask for Christ's help as we build ourselves back up. But the building of ourselves back up, this is, again, part of the issue with Western Christianity and part of what I really lean into in the indigenous worldview, is that they're strongly communitarian. They see themselves always in relationship, not just with one another, but also with the Creator, not just with the Creator, but also with the land that they inhabit. And so they're in this circle of community. And we so often see ourselves as individuals, like little islands in an ocean. And it's about us, and it's about me and my righteousness. It's about me and just me dealing with my sin. Well, has your sin ever only affected just you? That's never the case, right? And so your righteousness also needs to not just affect you. It needs to affect those around you.
Would you thank Danny this morning for his time?